Fat Chance by Roy Trumbull, copyright 2009, Chapter 16, Cash Card. The inept Bureaucracy Act had weeded out those government agencies with big budgets, many employees, and no discernible impact on their mandated portfolio. The Immigration and Naturalization Service headed the list. The number of illegals in the country remained nearly constant. The number of downright dangerous people who'd done all the paperwork and waltzed in the front door stayed the same. After folding it up and fumigating the marble halls, the INS mission was turned over to Internal Revenue. The U.S. had a declining population, and the only way to prop up Social Security and Medicare was to have more taxpayers. Immigration became a cash cow. To immigrate immediately required a $100,000 bond, which would be forfeit should you apply for any welfare program. To become a citizen required paying taxes on earned income for 5 consecutive years. If you missed paying 1 year, the clock reset to zero. In the meantime, you accrued no benefits. The old slow path to immigration remained in effect, but became much more difficult to pull off. The orange card that marked those here as bondsmen was known to all as a cash card. Needless to say, the bondsmen were in hock to whomever paid for their bond and thus were indentured servants, a circumstance not much different than from the days of colonial America. Any legal document signed by a bondsman had to be co-signed by his bondholder to be legal. In her research, Marilyn turned up a number of bondsmen employed by Johnson Accounting or their related businesses. Try as she might, she could not find anyone born in the United States. She also turned up adoptions of minor children by bondsmen. Horace and Ronald Lee and Gerald Johnson had co-signed many documents. They, in turn, were naturalized citizens who'd come here after posting their own bonds. Larry Sharp kept a few extra shirts and slacks in his closet, as well as other clothes in his bottom drawer for Danny and Milt. They would come to his apartment and shower, trim their facial hair, then go with him to whatever gig he was providing. Today they were seated at a long table in the mayor's outer office going over raw poll data. Danny had his nose buried in a stack of computer printouts. Milt sat nearby eyeing the secretaries and the office safe. He soon lost interest in the safe. He wasn't into legacy tin cans. Louise was on the phone and saying something far too candid. Larry was out of his chair and standing next to him trying to shove in the damping rods. Louie! Without looking up, Danny said, Kingsman, 1963. I think they're still doing it at Beach Blanket Babylon. Larry didn't get it, but Louise started to laugh. It was the all-time classic sight gag. In San Francisco, the curtains would open at the Club Fugazi. You'd see the French king in his royal robes with curled hair piled a foot high and dangling down below his shoulders, posing for all he's worth. And then you'd hear, Louis, Louis. Hard to believe its composer Richard Berry only got $750. Later, Danny and the mayor were talking. Don't assume you have the Hispanic vote tied up. You'll carry much of it, maybe the majority. You'll need to meet with a lot of community groups and appear at public events to shore it up. The Indian businessmen are important, too. Up in Silicon Gulch, there's plenty of Indian entrepreneurs. They're a good source of campaign money. When you get away from the major cities, the remaining counties in California are just like red states. If you can campaign enough to increase your percentage in those counties by 5 to 10%, it would divert energy and funds of your opponent who could no longer take them for granted. Organize your supporters in those areas to get out the vote. It'll put the heat on. Benny Hermosa was sitting at the other end of the table taking notes. He had a dreamy look in his eyes. In his jacket pocket, he had a piece of paper with La Bonita's cell phone number on it. Abe looked at the lab analysis of his skin. Maya had been right. He'd been to Bel Porcino only hours before he'd met with Coroner Bob. The samples taken from his skin were close twins to what had been taken from Ralph Nixon's body. He needed samples from just one other person to verify his suspicion that some chemical was involved during a massage. When Abe had been a rookie, his beat had included the produce district. It began at 2 a.m. Trucks came and went all night. In front of each stall were open boxes with apples, grapes, pears, lettuce, melons, and so on. If it had been a good night, the stocks were depleted and the order came to sell the flesh. That's what they called the boxes on display. They were supposed to be representative of the stock, but they'd been cherry-picked to look really good. Since then, Abe realized a lot of things in the public eye were just the flesh. The ordinary were the world's real stock in trade who got things done. He was walking past a coffee shop when he spotted Milt Eccles sitting at the counter. He'd caught Milt fair and square once in what could have been a felony rap. Milt traded information for a plea bargain. It helped Abe with some otherwise dead cases. The DA reduced the charges and Milt got off for time served. Abe sat down beside him and ordered coffee. Milt turned and said, "Hi, Abe. Much nicer to see you on the outside than on the inside." Abe asked him what he was doing. Milt told him he had a gig in the mayor's office. That raised Abe's eyebrows, but when he found out it was really Danny who had the gig, he understood. "How are you at databases?" "You must mean cracking databases?" "Which ones?" Abe leaned over toward him and said, "INS. Doing a little genealogy, I suppose?" Abe smiled at him but said nothing. "They're part of IRS now, but they haven't integrated the databases yet. A 12-year-old hacker could bust in. I've got a short list of names. They're all naturalized citizens. I just want to know their countries of origin. I'll owe you one." "You could do this legit, you know." "To do it, I'd need to make a case before the chief and then before a federal judge, and I'm a little short on hard evidence. I need your research skills to see if I'm on the right track. Meet me in the computer room of the main library tomorrow at 2. Either I will or I won't have something. It's clean that way. No phone calls, no emails, no traceable files." Abe had something else on his mind. Marilyn had been an occasional visitor in the past, and now they were together most of the time. Which of them should give up their apartment? Were they ready to make it official? She hadn't said anything, and neither had he. They'd reached a point of mutual trust. He'd found out about her visit to Horace. She'd exercised her right of "he's mine." Well, damn it, she was his. He thought of all the short and long-term relationships in his past. This was different. It's one thing to be on the prowl in your 20s, but quite another to be alone in your 40s. He wanted a companion, someone who was strong and steady. He didn't have to look too far to find her. B. Windermere had a massage from a nice young man named Michael. He had dark curly hair and was very handsome and muscular. He had a firm, soft voice, and B. just melted. He touched her and she fell asleep and dreamed she had a 5.2 on the Big O scale. When she awoke and realized how very wet she felt, she couldn't stop blushing. As she was leaving, she told Karen that if Horace wasn't available the next time, she wouldn't mind having Michael again. Karen reached into her drawer and penciled another line on a tally sheet. That was 23 so far. Out in the parking lot, she ran into Abe. He was holding a jar containing cotton swabs. He had a favor to ask. B didn't know what it was going to be, but at the moment she was inclined to agree to almost anything.